From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A federal grand jury indicted 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities with accusations that they interfered with the U.S. election in 2016. However, the complaint did not contain any allegations that the efforts of the parties influenced the outcome of the election in 2016. The indictment accuses defendants of, quote, supporting the presidential campaign of then-candidate Donald J. Trump and disparaging Hillary Clinton, closed quote. It claims the defendants staged political rallies and bought political advertising while posing as grassroots entities. The document said an organization known as the Internet Research Agency, quote, sought in part to conduct what it called information warfare against the United States of America, closed quote, through fictitious U.S. personas on social media platforms and other Internet-based media. This was Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein at a press conference Friday.
Good afternoon. A grand jury in the District of Columbia today returned an indictment presented by the Special Counsel's Office. The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election. The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general. According to the allegations in the indictment, 12 of the individual defendants worked at various times for a company called Internet Research Agency, LLC, a Russian company based in St. Petersburg. The other individual defendant, Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin, funded the conspiracy through companies known as Concord Management and Consulting, LLC, Concord Catering, and many affiliates and subsidiaries. The conspiracy was part of a larger operation called Project Lochta. Project Lochta included multiple components, some involving domestic audiences within the Russian Federation, and others targeting foreign audiences in multiple countries. Internet Research Agency allegedly operated through Russian shell companies. It employed hundreds of people in its online operations, ranging from creators of fictitious personas to technical and administrative support personnel with an annual budget of millions of dollars. Internet Research Agency was a structured organization headed by a management group and arranged into departments, including graphics, search engine optimization, information technology, and finance departments. In 2014, the company established a translator project focused on the United States. In July of 2016, more than 80 employees were assigned to the translator project. Two of the defendants allegedly traveled to the United States in 2014 to collect intelligence for their American influence operations. In order to hide the Russian origins of their activities, the defendants allegedly purchased space on computer servers located here in the United States in order to set up a virtual private network. The defendants allegedly used that infrastructure to establish hundreds of accounts on social media networks such as Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, making it appear that those accounts were controlled by persons located in the United States. They used stolen or fictitious American identities, fraudulent bank accounts, and false identification documents. The defendants posed as politically and socially active Americans, advocating for and against particular candidates. They established social media pages and groups to communicate with unwitting Americans. They also purchased political advertisements on social media networks. The Russians also recruited and paid real Americans to engage in political activities, promote political campaigns, and stage political rallies. The defendants and their co-conspirators pretended to be grassroots activists. According to the indictment, the Americans did not know that they were communicating with Russians. After the election, the defendants allegedly staged rallies to support the president-elect while simultaneously staging rallies to protest his election. For example, the defendants organized one rally to support the president-elect and another rally to oppose him, both in New York on the same day. On September 13th of 2017, soon after the news media reported that the special counsel's office was investigating evidence that Russian operatives had used social media to interfere with the 2016 election, one defendant allegedly wrote, quote, "We had a slight crisis here at work. The FBI busted our activity. So I got preoccupied with covering tracks together with my colleagues," end quote. The indictment includes 8 criminal counts. Count 1 alleges a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States by all of the defendants. The defendants allegedly conspired to defraud America by impairing the lawful functions of the Federal Election Commission, the United States Department of Justice, and the Department of State. Those organizations of the U.S. government are responsible for administering federal requirements for disclosure of foreign involvement in certain domestic activities. Count 2 charges conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud by Internet Research Agency and 2 of the individual defendants. And counts 3 through 8 charge aggravated identity theft by Internet Research Agency and 4 individuals. Now, there is no allegation in this indictment that any American was a knowing participant in this illegal activity. There is no allegation in the indictment that the charged conduct altered the outcome of the 2016 election. I want to caution you that everyone charged with a crime is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty in court. At trial, prosecutors must introduce credible evidence that is sufficient to prove each defendant guilty beyond any reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury. The special counsel's investigation is ongoing. There will be no comments from the special counsel at this time. This indictment serves as a reminder that people are not always who they appear to be on the internet. The indictment alleges that the Russian conspirators want to promote discord in the United States and undermine public confidence in democracy. We must not allow them to succeed. The Department of Justice will continue to work cooperatively with other law enforcement and intelligence agencies and with the Congress to defend our nation against similar current and future efforts. I want to thank the federal agents and prosecutors who are working on this case for their exceptional service, and I'll be happy to take a few questions.
Is there concern that this indictment undermines the outcome of the election?
What I've identified for you are the allegations in the indictment. There's no allegation in the indictment of any effect on the outcome of the election. Jessica.
On page 4 of the indictment, paragraph 6, it specifically talks about the Trump campaign, saying that defendants communicated with unwitting individuals associated with the Trump campaign. My question is, later in the indictment, campaign officials are referenced, not by their name, by campaign official 1 or 2 or 3. Were campaign officials cooperative, or were they duped? What was their relationship with this?
Again, there's no allegation in this indictment that any American had any knowledge. And the nature of the scheme was that the defendants took extraordinary steps to make it appear that they were ordinary American political activists, even going so far as to base their activities on a virtual private network here in the United States. If anybody traced it back to that first jump, they appear to be Americans. Catherine.
One more question. Have you had any assurances from the Russians that they will provide these individuals for prosecution?
There's been no communication with the Russians about this. We'll follow the ordinary process of seeking cooperation and extradition.
Thank you. Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, said the accusations of Russian meddling reflected the absurdity of the, quote, modern American political reality, closed quote. Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesperson for Russia's President Vladimir Putin, said that the Kremlin was, quote, not yet familiar, closed quote, with the indictments and had no further comment. Relations between the U.S. and Russia are at the lowest since at least 1991, when the Soviet Union was dissolved. It's in that context that the announcement by the Trump administration that it was moving ahead with former President Barack Obama's plans for a $1 trillion makeover of the U.S. nuclear arsenal has raised fears among those who follow such things. BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford spoke with one such person, Greg Mello, executive director of Los Alamos Study Group. Mello has reviewed the proposal and finds it very scary, noting that it was President Obama who was determined to create the present adversarial relationship with the Russians.
President Obama kind of talked left and cut right. The 2010 Obama Nuclear Posture Review made some dovish sounds, and I think that we could discuss at length how sincere they were, but it really doesn't matter. By the end of his administration, he had committed to a very large investment in nuclear weapons and hardly any nuclear disarmament. And within his administration, Russia phobes and hawks were gradually gaining ground until by the end was all he could do to either wash his hands of some issues or try to restrain in a few places. So his policies ended up far more hawkish than his nuclear posture review. That's the place where Trump started. Trump's nuclear posture review takes that and adds more small usable nuclear weapons, the idea which was always implicit that the United States might use nuclear weapons in a conventional conflict up to that point. That's always been there, but Trump has kind of highlighted that and put some proposals for more usable nuclear weapons in there because they're terribly Russophobic and they're very concerned about the loss of power of the U.S. empire. And they think that nuclear weapons can somehow be a winning weapon.
Yes, Trump is talking about nuclear retaliation for cyber attacks.
I think that for a lot of Americans, they haven't been really aware of what a potential first use policy of nuclear weapons really entails. It means using nuclear weapons because a non-nuclear attack has occurred somewhere, either attack on the United States of some nature, like a cyber attack, or an attack on U.S. troops somewhere where they might lose, or U.S. ships. So that's always been there, but Trump has showcased it to an alarming degree.
Yes, the U.S. has never forsworn first strike. And in fact, standard U.S. nuclear posture back in the day was to respond in nuclear fashion if there were a massive conventional Soviet attack in Western Europe.
Exactly. And the basic idea remains the same. The circumstances are a little different. The cyber attack has somewhat taken the place of an attack in Europe, although I suppose an attack in Europe is back on the table because we are very much creating mischief wherever we can in the immediate area of Russia, especially Ukraine right now.
Yes, in today's world, the Russians, not Soviets anymore, would only have to cross their own border to confront NATO.
Correct. We just kept expanding NATO. It started with a Democrat, Bill Clinton, in second term. And it's gone on ever since, and Russia feels very much cornered. They don't like to see panzer divisions on their western border, which was intentionally done to send a signal. You know, that's the kind of thing that these neoconservatives that are scattered throughout government and in high places, people have told me that they just love that. They just want to do things to drive Russia crazy.
I'm a senior citizen, and all of my life, the Republicans have been considered the more hawkish, but that has changed.
Absolutely, it has. And I feel the same way, Glenn, and it's kind of it's something we talk about and try to deal with all the time, and how liberals, progressives have become manipulated to be the tacit allies of the military-industrial complex in vilifying Russia, which has no factual basis. And of all the things that we should be working on, the justice issues, the climate change, making sure that we have a social contract in this country, for some reason we're mobilizing to vilify Russia and protect the FBI of all things. We don't have any real organized senior level Democratic Party opposition to war at this point.
And that includes Bernie Sanders, who has very little to say about foreign policy. And when he does speak, he's hawkish as well.
That's quite true. I saw an essay not too long ago, just a few days ago, that has been rolling around in the back of my mind, that some of our progressive leaders are in many ways like liberal Republicans of the 1950s, like Eisenhower. And I haven't really assessed the full truth of that or absorbed it, really, but I know there is at least some truth to that, if not a lot.
Well, certainly the alliance between the top of the Democratic Party, as personified by Hillary Clinton, became evident in the campaign with the CIA and other intelligence operatives becoming quite politicized in their support for the Clinton candidacy.
Totally true. And this phenomenon is very new to our experience, where there's no check right now, no real check or balance. We've got a very short-circuited connection between the dominant media and ex-government officials and the intelligence agencies, so that these, like CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, become almost stenographic in their relaying of messages from deep state, if you want to use that term, the permanent foreign policy elite in the country. And there's a feedback that's going on from those media back to Congress. People are very busy. They don't have a lot of time to listen to and weigh alternative media. They read the New York Times and Washington Post while they're rushing to a midnight vote. So they think they know a lot of things which they don't know, which are not really true. So you've got Trump's volatility, and the people around him are, many of them, neoconservative, not all, and then the generals, which are all too prominent in this administration. And then on the other side, you have what? You have mild rebukes of nuclear policy, but, you know, really basically Democrats support about 90% of it. So there isn't really an opposition. And I'm hoping that we can all wake up before we pass watershed moments where it's much more difficult.
What kind of impact has this new nuclear posture had on Russian policy and pronouncements?
That's a very good question. And the idea of the authors is that Russia will essentially back down, that some of the worst parts of the nuclear posture review are fashioned as explicitly as bargaining chips, so that we would drop these ideas if Russia dropped, say, the caliber nuclear cruise missile, which could carry nuclear weapons. But it really isn't seen this way in Russia. Russia doesn't have the policy about nuclear weapons, which the nuclear posture review says it has. From the Russian perspective, they would only use nuclear weapons if they felt that their country was on the verge of being annihilated. So they feel that the ultimate goal of U.S. policy is some kind of regime change or degradation of sovereignty in Russia, which I think is correct. Henry Kissinger even said as much when Obama was in power. And so they would use nuclear weapons only if they felt the very existence of their country was at risk, which is very similar to the United States perspective. In that case, they're not going to back down because we have an exact comparable nuclear weapon to theirs. It's just a fallacious idea, but one that happens to generate tens of billions of extra dollars to the nuclear weapons industries and probably hundreds of billions for the defense industry in general.
You say that the goal, and that would be a bipartisan goal, is to break Russia. I suppose these folks think that they broke the Soviets and they can do it again with the present folks in the Kremlin.
Yes, I think that's correct. My conversations with people, including in the Obama White House, have left me with that strong impression. I think there's a whole generation of senior people in the Democratic Party who cut their teeth during the Clinton years, which is a fairly long time, that think that the normal state of the world is that the United States is basically in charge of Russia, and it's a less than fully sovereign country. And the prospect of Russia being fully sovereign, you know, it's stretching from Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific, from the Arctic to the Middle East, that is so horrifying to the neoconservatives that they feel that something has to be done, and that something is subjugation of Russia. But that is not going to happen.
And we've only been talking about Russia and the United States, but there are other nuclear powers, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and of course the U.S. allies, France and Britain.
Absolutely. Some of what's in the Nuclear Posture Review is certainly related to the rise of China. The RAND Corporation did a study which only confirms what the person on the street would think as well, that Chinese military power is growing. The United States is not guaranteed to prevail in China in a war. So this also causes panic. And when arguing with people in Washington about whether to develop a new nuclear-tipped cruise missile, which is an Obama plan, the answer I got from an assistant secretary of defense was, well, we don't want Japan or South Korea to develop their own nuclear weapons, so we better do this to defend that region against China. That implies defending someone with a nuclear cruise missile implies a willingness to use it.
We all know that the military and politics are inextricably intertwined, but I get the impression that you believe that the U.S. nuclear posture is based much more on politics and ideology than on the science behind nuclear weapons and the science behind the livability of the planet.
It's a totally political document, ideological document. You know, the original drafters, people whose name was on the original drafts, were Keith Payne from the National Institute of Public Policy, who was very hard right ideologue in the Reagan administration. And so the origin of this document is really tied with the darkest times and ideas of the Cold War. And it was walked back from there by generals. And nowhere is there any kind of statesman-like understanding of the world as it is today and the existential issues facing humankind, any no kind of human solidarity or diplomacy. It's just all war all the time. It's a very relatively narrow echo chamber that produces this kind of document. You know, the people have a military background. They go to military colleges. They listen to the same think tanks. They spend their time with each other. And they reinforce each other's ideas, and they're not going out into either party, really, into understanding what the climate scientists are saying and what the needs of ordinary Americans are.
Well, we've always had Dr. Strangeloves in the military, but have the American people as a whole become inured to the prospect of nuclear annihilation and human extinction?
Geez, that's a scary idea, but it's an important question. To a certain extent, the apocalyptic imagination has become part of our mainstream zeitgeist through video games. Where I am in Albuquerque, there's a trampoline center which is called Fallout, and it's decorated on the inside with a mural showing a post-apocalyptic landscape of ruins where the city of Albuquerque used to be. Yes, I think we are getting numbed a little bit, and at the same time, we don't understand the reality of it all. Someone said to me recently that it's a little like if you've never been in a car accident of any kind, it may not seem real to you what can happen. And in a nuclear war is that many times over. We can't imagine what it would be like to have basically the sun appear over your city. Something brighter than the sun at an altitude of a few hundred meters or a mile, burning everything up completely.
What would you like those of us who have not been numbed to the idea of being burnt to a cinder? What should we be doing? What should our response be?
We should be demanding dialogue with the Russians and to stop this ridiculous criminalization of diplomacy. We should be demanding a social contract that doesn't treat human beings like they're disposable. We should be demanding investments in renewable energy that create lots of jobs and career tracks for people. Demand basically an end to the militarization of society and the beginning of a society based on solidarity and sustainability. We can do this in public in 100 different ways, from demonstrations at our congressional delegation offices, to letters to the editor, to study groups at churches and social organizations. It's hard for us. We can't even imagine giving up our big trucks or the way of life that we've had up to now. But, you know, we will if insist on trying to maintain a global empire. The world is very big. It's indomitable. We can't afford it. And the people who will pay the price are the people who have been paying the price all along, only more so.
In general, folks seem to think that Donald Trump is more warlike and more likely to start a war than Barack Obama. Whether that's true or not, does that present a kind of opportunity for anti-war people to mobilize a public response to the U.S. war machine?
It does. It absolutely does. We can use the awareness of Donald Trump's volatility and the dominance of the military around him is an opportunity for us. But at the same time, we mustn't be naive and think that a person like Hillary Clinton, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, would be some kind of peacenik. Many of us were very concerned about Mrs. Clinton and her methodical, imperial, Russophobic willingness to intervene. The destruction of Libya, that's on her desk. She did that. So we can't be naive about the mainstream Democratic Party and just make this into an anti-Trump campaign.
That was Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group speaking from Albuquerque.
Meanwhile, this past week saw a meeting of the defense ministers of the NATO members in Brussels. Press TV's Jerome Hughes has more.
At a time when Russia is increasing its spending on defense, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg has warned that unless the Western bloc's budget is increased, its credibility will be seriously undermined because the alliance will not be able to purchase new equipment or increase its number of military exercises.
Sure that we are able.
A whole range of issues were discussed during the two-day meeting of NATO defense ministers here in Brussels. The alliance is concerned that its role will be undermined if the new EU army, currently being established, duplicates NATO's functions. 22 of the 29 countries in NATO are also members of the European Union.
They will really be the losers if they end up with two competing structures, with two competing capability targets and lists. So this has to be coherent.
Stoltenberg has confirmed that just 8 NATO countries will meet their financial commitments to the alliance this year, despite huge pressure from Donald Trump for NATO members to pay more. Regarding tensions between NATO allies, the US and Turkey over Ankara's operations in Syria, Stoltenberg has called on Turkey to respond to security concerns in a measured way. The NATO ministers agreed to set up 2 new major bases in response to what they call a more assertive Russia. Those are likely to be located in the US and Germany. At the event, US Defense Secretary James Mattis accused Russia and Iran of playing destabilizing roles in the Middle East. Analysts say exactly the opposite is true, pointing out US-led forces were unable to defeat Daesh in Syria and Iraq.
When Russians begin with Syrian army, with even Hezbollah and Iranians to fight Daesh, we now see that Daesh is losing the war.
Top NATO officials are on tenterhooks, especially relating to the issue of funding, as they prepare for a summit this summer in Brussels, which will be attended by Donald Trump. The head of the alliance is most important.
So be very, very careful.
But now also its most unpredictable member. Jerome Hughes, Press TV at NATO headquarters, Brussels.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.